Okay, well, thank you very much for coming. I am Mordechai Torchiner, and I am honored to be in your presence, so Rachel is very kind. And I was asked to offer a class, and the topic that I chose came from three different topics that I gave the office. But I selected this as one of the three topics because it's one that I feel people know about, but perhaps could use a little bit more hard information on. And I titled it Running Your Tzedakah Like a Business. There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, which says that one should not tithe omadut. Omadut with an aleph, it means by estimate. Meaning, when a person separates their maaser, we have produce grown in Israel, we're supposed to separate a certain percentage and it goes to the Kohen, another percentage it goes to the Levi, and so on. That you're not supposed to do it by estimation, this is what I think it should be, but rather, you make a precise calculation. So there's much to discuss about what exactly that lesson is meant to teach us, but on a very basic level, I think it is meant to teach us that we run our tzedakah like a business. Meaning, you are careful with it, that you have a set of priorities, that you have a proper bookkeeping. It shouldn't just be, somebody knocks on my door, or I see somebody in shul, or I get a letter in the mail, or a phone call, or whatever it is, and then I decide, spur of the moment, I guess this is what I'm going to give. It should be done with calculation as a mitzvah that we value. So I selected some practical questions that I receive from time to time with the note that people should please consult their rabbis for practical guidance. I'm not intending this to in any way supplant the role of the rabbi. I think that fundamentally the shul rabbis in particular should be setting policies for their community. But we're going to discuss some topics which I think are on people's minds just based on the questions that I get. I have five topics here. The first two I intend to discuss at the start, and then I'm going to ask you to select from the remaining three, because I don't think we'll get to all five in an hour. Maybe we'll surprise things, but generally speaking, that's not what I would expect. So the first two topics that I want to discuss are issues of gift size. Meaning, is it better to give one large gift or a few large gifts to particular causes, or to give many small gifts to a lot of recipients? That's one question. And then the second one is it better to give to people directly, or is it better to use some kind of an umbrella fund, like a UJA type of a thing, or a rabbi's discretionary fund at a synagogue, where there's an element of distance involved, and there's an expert who supposedly evaluates and knows the needs, and therefore is able to distribute better, perhaps, than somebody who is just giving as people come to them. So those are my two first points before we get to the others. The other questions that I have on here are prioritizing aid to Israel versus local needs. That's a perennial question. The fear of enabling. Meaning, am I, by giving somebody support, am I enabling them to continue without getting a job? The last one, does donor recognition undermine tzedakah? Should a person specifically do their tzedakah anonymously? Okay, those are the topics. So again, among the latter three, I'm going to ask you to vote. You'll see, people going by. That's the nature of a school. There's a classroom overhead. So hopefully they don't jump up and down on the floor of the classroom, and therefore we'll be okay. But we start out then with the first two questions, and that's a good reminder to me to ask people to silence their phones. My bad for forgetting to mention that. But in order to approach the first two of our topics, the issue of one large gift or many small gifts, and the issue of giving directly versus giving to an umbrella fund, I think it's important that we first establish why we're giving tzedakah. Now, you'll say, well, because it's a mitzvah. God told me to, right? The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah has that. It asks the question of, why will you blow shofar? And the Gemara comes back with the response of, what do you mean, why do we blow shofar? God said, blow shofar. Like, why is this a question? And then they go on and elaborate, no, we didn't mean that, we meant this. But, you know, the answer to why we give tzedakah is God said so. Nonetheless, there are clear benefits, results of giving tzedakah that I want to look at, because once we know why we're doing it, we'll also have a better sense of how to do it. So, why do we give tzedakah? What's the goal?
To help the person, but also we're supposed to, the way you said.
Right. So, there is the overarching, yes, I have a mitzvah, but helping the recipient, right, is the most basic element of this. If you take a look at source number one of the Torah statements of the mitzvah of tzedakah, the pauper will never disappear from the midst of the land. Therefore, I instruct you, open your hand to your brother, your pauper, your indigent person in your land. Okay? Because there are people who need. There will always be need. Don't kid yourself. You're not solving the problem. Yeah, that's not the goal. The goal is you help people who are in need. Morris.
Can I get you a definition for this one's doctrine? Is it for Evyon, when you talk about giving money to, let's say, the Heart and Stroke Foundation, is that also to be halachically stuck out?
Good. That's a really good question. That was one of those I left on the cutting room floor when I was preparing this. But since you asked the question,
part of your taxes might be considered, since there is income redistribution. In any liberal democracy.
Right, so that's a separate question. Let me first deal with the first question and then the second question. The first question of giving to a Heart and Stroke Foundation, you give to a yeshiva.
Yeah.
Right? Does that count as well as tzedakah? So the answer seems to be, based on the pasuk, that no, the core mitzvah of tzedakah is to give to people who need food. Right, what we usually think of as ani and evyon, people who are indigent. That can be expanded in other settings besides food. So in other words, because they are indigent, they can't afford to get an education. Because they are indigent, they can't afford to have health care. So therefore, I can contribute to funds that will enable, a scholarship fund that can contribute to those sorts of things that will provide for people who are needy. So, no problem. We're just dealing with a tangential question that came up, which is we looked at the first source. We were talking about goals of giving tzedakah, why people give besides the fact that it's a mitzvah. And the first goal we established is to aid the needy, which is the way it's framed in source number one. But then the question was, so if that's the case, then when you give to the Heart and Stroke Foundation, does that qualify as tzedakah? To which my answer is the most basic framework that the Torah gives is indeed helping the needy, providing them with food, although, as we noted, it could be expanded to include providing them with the means of education, providing them with the means of health care. Fundamentally, though, it's about helping the needy. And the other ways in which we give tzedakah are, in fact, considered to be secondary. They're not considered to be as important. So that Rabbi Moshe Heineman did a remarkable job a few decades ago in Baltimore of coming up with a set of guidelines, which they published within the city. And if I remember correctly, one of his principles that he established is that the simple majority of one's tzedakah expenditures should be to directly help needy people, as opposed to some of the institutional tzedakah that people engage in, even though institutional tzedakah will trickle down to help those who are needy and couldn't manage these things themselves. Yes?
So if a portion goes, or a big portion goes to administration, is that considered ethical?
So that's a really good question also, not on the list either, but I'll mention it again, just because, again, it was asked, and I'll come back to your question also that you've had. But that's a really good question that's much discussed, and the answer seems to be that it's considered justified as long as it is standard overhead, meaning everybody knows that a business has employees, and everybody knows that in order to be able to collect funds, you're going to need to pay somebody. However, you have to make sure that you don't transcend that everybody knows area, not for two reasons. One is the issue of donor intent. It's very important within halacha that donor intent be honored. The Gemara in Bava Basra talks about this issue. One of the things that I expect we will get to a little bit later, the Gemara talks about somebody who wants to earmark tzedakah. So, for example, you see somebody on the street, and you want to help them, but you're concerned about where the money is going to go. So you say, I want you to use this for food, or I want you to use this for clothing, or, you know, whatever it is. Is that binding in the eyes of Jewish law? And the answer seems to be yes. Now, what they're going to do, I mean, how much are you going to be able to follow up? Not really. But it is, at least in theory, binding. So that leads to a tshuva, responsum. I want to say it's from Rabbi Moshe Sternbach. I think he was the one who addressed this question. He was asked about a tzedakah in which the person who was collecting was taking large sums for administration, if you will. And he had been asked to write a letter endorsing the tzedakah, and he refused. He said, based on what you're taking as overhead, I can't in good faith endorse the tzedakah. And he ended up writing a letter endorsing the tzedakah, but not the collector. That was his way to frame it. If anybody wants to see it, just email me my address at the top of the page, and I'll be glad to send you the actual response on that. But that's one issue, is the issue of donor intent. And then the other issue is that you're cheating the recipients of the tzedakah themselves, because people donate, and the recipient is missing a good chunk of it. So it's really, it's something that's going to be dependent on the situation. What sort of efforts are they putting into it? I did a program when I was a shul rabbi in Pennsylvania. I did a program for teens in which I actually taught them how to read the Form 990 that charities would have to file, so that they'd be able to learn about what was going for program expenses and what was going for publicity, overhead, all the other things that are done. Because I wanted them to get that understanding that you do have to look at it. It isn't just a matter of saying, "Wow, this helps sick children. I want to give them everything." You have to look more carefully at it. The other question that was asked was the question of, what about if my tax dollars are going for organizations that we consider worthy stock organizations?
Anyway, and it's, like I said, it's income redistribution there also.
Right. So the basic answer is that which I am required to give, that which I'm going to go to jail if I don't give it, is hard to construe as tzedakah. Because that's not why I'm not giving it to help people, I'm giving it to stay out of jail. Whereas if it's something that is an optional thing, That's a different story. That's the short answer. There's more to be said about it. This question comes up in terms of day school tuition, or high school tuition for that matter, meaning a certain chunk of what one gives for tuition is realistically going to subsidize people who can't afford to pay full tuition. So can you make the argument that a chunk of what you're giving is actually tzedakah because it's supporting education for others? And that argument is indeed made by some halachic authorities. And then the response comes back, well, you have to. You have no choice. But the answer is, I do have a choice. I could go to the scholarship committee just like everybody else does. And then I wouldn't end up needing to subsidize other people. So there is that argument to be made. But coming back to why we give tzedakah, what the goals of tzedakah are. So we've established a first goal. Come on in. Water's fine. We've established a first goal of aiding the needy. I'm going to go a little further with this.
Another goal.
Oh, you say another goal. Go for it, please.
Remaking the world in your own image, meaning that even if you're saying it's for the needy, if you happen to be a candlestick maker, you might decide to help the other candlestick makers who have fallen in hard times. In other words, even within that goal, there's an element of remaking the world in a way that you prefer as opposed to others.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but I grant you that as a subcategory. It reminds me of the story that the Talmud tells. The Gemara in Sukkah talks about a shul in Alexandria. And whenever I remember that story, I remember a speech by my shul rabbi when I was growing up. He talked about how when you went, if you would walk around shul during davening, at a certain point, it was a little bit noisy at one point in the shul's history. You may be familiar with shuls like that. He said you could actually read the newspaper by going section to section in the shul, because if you went there, they were talking sports. If you went there, they were talking business, real estate. I'm reminded of that because the Gemara in Sukkah tells the story of this large shul in Alexandria, in which people sat by guild. So all the coppersmiths sat here, all the tailors sat there, and the idea was when you came to town and didn't know anyone, that was how you would find your chevra, basically, and you would get work that way. So that's what you remind me of with the candlestick maker helping the other candlestick makers. That's where you would sit with them, and that would actually assist
and
you.
In Europe, they studied Mishnah that way because we found old Mishnahs at the Nazi property of the Woodworkers Guild.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
And so they obviously in Poland and in various places studied as that way. Which
very interesting. I didn't know that.
I find tremendous. But then from university days, there's something called psychic pay. And that's one of the other reasons why you do something. It really makes you feel good.
That's a separate point, though, because I'm trying to do it in terms of what the Torah's goals for you are. Yes, there are secondary gains involved in giving tzedakah.
That's why.
A second goal, yeah.
No, just waving.
That wasn't a bid. Okay, so a second goal is to specifically tie into and honor a mitzvah that the Torah gives of Maaser Ani. We know that, I mentioned before, Israeli produce has to be tithed. So some of the tithes are consistent year after year. It's the same thing. You give a certain percentage to the Kohen, for example. That's called Truma. However, there's a 10% tithe, which is used for different purposes in different years. The tithing system is a six-year cycle, followed by the seventh year, which is the sabbatical year and doesn't have tithing. But but your six-year cycle, there's a pattern which I always think of in terms of the children's game, Duck, Duck, Goose, because it works for this. Your first and second year, the 10% is brought to Jerusalem and eaten there. Your third year, that 10% instead is given to the needy. Then your fourth and fifth year, it goes to Jerusalem. And then the sixth year, it goes to the needy. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, duck, duck, goose. So the first 2 years and the fourth and fifth year, it is going to Jerusalem. Your third and sixth year, it's actually being given as Maaser Ani, as a tithe that goes to the needy. And one way that people frame this is that the mitzvah of giving 10%, as people often calculate it, is a way to extend Maaser Ani, to extend the tithe that we give to the needy. I brought you one verse. I'm not even sure why I did it exactly, but if you take a look at source number 2, one of the verses regarding is spending a tenth. Aser to aser, you shall surely tithe, but specifically aser, one-tenth, is something that people do. Yes?
But you're saying that the actual tzedakah is one-third of 10%, because I'm spending it on myself when I go, either I take it physically to Israel, or I translate it into money, which has a penalty, and I spend the money in Israel, if I understand it correctly.
To Jerusalem.
Yeah, to Jerusalem, not to Israel. So I'm spending it on myself there.
Yes, that's not tzedakah.
But it's part of the tithing.
Right, because the word tithe has been co-opted by the Christians to make it into tzedakah,
so
but the word tithe
actual,
is separated.
So the actual tzedakah is 3% over that six-year period. It's a third, it's 10% every 3 years for...
Yes and no, because you could also look at what you're giving to the Kohen and the Levi, as a form of tzedakah. I wouldn't dismiss that, even though it's an obligation and even though it's going to a very targeted population. I hear the calculation you're making. I understand what you're saying. It's important to recognize, and I'm not going to really go into it in the discussion, but I think it's important to recognize that there are two separate issues, really. One is, if I see somebody in need, I have to help support them. That has nothing to do with the 10%. Separate from that is the custom of separating 10% and giving it to the needy. It's its own discussion about how that works. What if I've exhausted my 10%, but somebody comes to me and they need help? How did that tie in? It's a good question, just not for right now. But my point in bringing you the one-tenth, which is referenced here in this verse, among other verses, is that some suggest that an element of giving tzedakah is not just, yes, I'm helping the needy, but also to mirror the biblical one-tenth tithings that go on. So if you take a look at source number 3, Rabbi Ovadia Bar Tanura, commenting on the first Mishnah in Peah, which lists various mitzvot, he says, and I'm going to read my English translation aloud in the interests of time, regarding kindness with one's funds, Gemilas Chasadin de Mamono, regarding kindness with one's funds, such as redeeming captives, clothing people, feeding them, and so on, there's a maximum threshold of giving one-fifth of one's funds each time the mitzvah comes to hand. The reason why I bring this is not the one-fifth cap, which is interesting also. The reason I bring it is simply that he is discussing a set of biblical obligations and includes among the biblical obligations the use of one's funds to help other people. And the truth is that this quote is not a great quote because it doesn't actually bring a one-tenth part, which is what I'd wanted. So I'm gonna have to go back to the drawing board on that one. I'm not sure why I brought without the one-tenth. But I'm gonna jump to source number 4. Rabbi Yechiel Michel Epstein, author of a modern code of Jewish law called the Aruch HaShulchan, which is a very influential code of law, and he says the thresholds of one-tenth and one-fifth are not biblical. It's rabbinic, linked to Aser HaAserenu Lach. When Yaakov is running away from his brother Esav, he says to God, take care of me, and if you do, whatever I receive, I'm going to separate a tenth to give back to you. So some suggest that's why we do the one-tenth for tzedakah. We're mirroring what Yaakov did. It's not so much about maser ani, as you know, it's not really about the biblical tithe, as much as it's about matching Yaakov's decision of, I'm going to give a tenth back to God. And then some suggest that it's actually neither biblical nor rabbinic. I brought you a source in number 5. I'm rushing a little bit with this. This view is that it's not biblical, it's not rabbinic, it's actually minhag. It's custom. The idea of doing a tenth is a matter of custom. It's just what we do. That matters a great deal. Not in terms of diminishing the importance of the practice, because it doesn't, but it matters in terms of a person deciding what they want to spend the money on. Meaning, if indeed we call this practice a custom, then you can make the argument, and some do, that each individual establishes how they're going to do the custom in their own way. In other words, when you are, you know, however old you are, when you receive your first income or your first gift, and now you're going to give your 10%, you are establishing how you're going to do tzedakah in the future. So, for example, go back to Morris's question about what qualifies as a recipient for tzedakah. A person decides at the very beginning that they're going to give to these causes, that this is going to count, so to speak. And it's like a neder, it's like a vow, and it becomes binding. So if a person says when they're, you know, 13 years old or 14 years old or whatever it is, and they got their bar mitzvah gifts, their bat mitzvah gifts, and they want to give tzedakah, and they say, you know, I only want to use it to give to the needy, that becomes binding. This is their way of engaging in the minhag. But this is a little bit of a side point. I just wanted to show you that, in addition to aiding the needy, we have biblical precedent for the idea of the one-tenth in particular, and maybe that's what we're extending when we do the one-tenth, whether it's biblical, rabbinic, or custom. The third part of this, though, the third goal is the one that I really wanted to make sure to highlight. And that is the reflective part of tzedakah. Meaning, it's not only about who's on the receiving end. It's not only about echoing biblical verses and rituals. It's also about improving ourselves, developing ourselves as merciful people. And this comes back to why I didn't want to say the 3%, because there are other ways in which Israeli produce is subject to tzedakah. One example of that is the mitzvah of Peya. Anybody know what the mitzvah of Peya is about? Corner, right? The edge, right? When people use the term peyos to refer to the hair here, it's the corners of the head, pa'at harosh. But in this case, peya, what we're talking about is the corner of the field. And the idea is, as the Torah says, when you are harvesting from your field, you're supposed to leave the end for the needy. Supposed to leave a little bit at the end. The Torah does not give you any statement of what the percentage is. That's discussed rabbinically. But the value of this is more than just another way to help needy people. Take a look at source number 6, please. The Sefer HaChinuch is a book collecting the Torah's 613 mitzvot. It largely follows the count that Rambam Maimonides made. It was written anonymously. There's some thought that it was Rabbi Aharon Halevi. It's not clear. But look at what he says about the mitzvah of Peya, of leaving the corner of the field. He says, God desired that his nation should be crowned in every good and precious trait, with a spirit of blessing and generosity. As I have already written, the soul is inspired by our activities. Right? That's a very important principle for the Sefer HaChinuch, is that you affect yourself, your personality, by your actions. And so it, the soul, will become good, and God's blessing will come to it. There's no doubt that when a person leaves some of his produce in his field, rendering it ownerless for all to benefit, you will see in his spirit satisfaction, a proper and blessed spirit, and a sense that God has sated him with his plenty and his spirit will rest in goodness. One who gathers everything into his house and who will not leave behind any blessing for the needy who saw the field with its standing grain and who longed to fill their desire with it, for they hunger, demonstrates a wicked heart and bad spirit. In other words, the person who says, I want to get everything, I want to get as much as I can out of this, is cultivating within himself a sense of greed, of I want it all. A person who knows from the get-go, I'm going to stop short of taking everything. Think about the advice I heard growing up as a kid from my parents about eating. And I'm not talking about the one that says have everything on your plate because there are starving children. I'm talking about the philosophy of leave something over. Don't take everything. You go to the smorgasbord and thank God they're beautiful and full and they have all sorts of different foods. You don't have to take everything. You can leave something out. There's an element of learning self-control in that case, which can be healthy. But in terms of this, the field, and saying, I'm going to stop short and leave it for the needy, you train yourself in generosity. It's a different point of view that says, I'm not out there just to take whatever I can take. So it's about the effect on the person who actually is giving the tzedakah. It's about the person who's giving the tzedakah, who also comes away having learned something from the experience. This has great practical applications. If you take a look at source number 7, this is always fun. The Torah has a mitzvah of what's called in Hebrew prika uti'ina, unloading and loading. Meaning, if you have if you see somebody whose animal is struggling with a burden, so you're supposed to help him to unload the animal. If he's having a hard time loading the animal, you're supposed to help him load the animal. When the Torah presents this, though, it's very interesting. At one point, it talks about if you see shor oyivcha, shor is an ox, the ox of your oyev, and oyev is an enemy. If you see your enemy's ox, you're supposed to help. Look what the Gemara deduces from the way the Torah presents the friend's animal versus the enemy's animal. One who has a choice. He could either unburden his friend's animal or load his foe's animal. You have your choice. You could help remove the burden from your friend's animal or you could load your enemy's animal. He's instructed to help his foe. Help the enemy first. Even though, when you think about it, the poor animal has a greater need when it comes to unloading. Right? When you think about which thing is bothering the animal more, it's having the burden on. He says, you have to take care of the enemy's animal first. Why? Lachof es yitzro. To control your spirit. So that you again, develop in yourself this element of aiding others, and I brought you one other source on this, in source number 8 from the Rambam, Maimonides, in his Laws of Kings. You have the English on the top of the second side. The sages have instructed us, he's talking about dealing with people who are not Jewish, and he says, the sages have instructed us to visit their sick, to bury their dead as we bury Jewish dead, that doesn't mean in the same cemetery, and to support their indigent along with Jewish indigent, to promote peaceful paths, and he gives you 2 verses. Number 1, God is good to all, and his mercy is upon all of his creations. And number 2, her path. The paths of Torah are pleasant paths, and all of her ways are peace. If you were writing this line, would you have needed both verses? Which one would you have selected? Sorry? The peace one, because that's the one that makes his point. If your point is promoting peaceful paths, then quote the second verse. Her paths are pleasant paths, and all of her ways are peace. Both verses are from Tehillim, they're from Psalms. Neither one is more authoritative than the other. Why did you need 2 verses?
It's good to all, the non-Jewish side of it.
So, good to all, yes, but also the point about mercy. You're developing your mercy. It does not feel better, although we talked about that before, but you become better. You become a more merciful person by aiding others, separate from the advantage of now you've helped everybody. So we have 3 goals when it comes to giving this 10%. One is aiding the needy. A second is mirroring, echoing biblical concepts of giving a tenth and developing our mercy. So because of that, we have certain priorities. Clearly, we have a priority of assisting people. We have a priority as well of aiding and developing our own mercy, and also the element of precision, because you're mirroring, again, the biblical practice of tithing. So let's get to how this affects the first 2 questions I mentioned. The issue of giving 1 large gift, or a couple of large gifts, versus giving a bunch of small gifts. A person, let's say, we're following the 10% model. When a person calculates what they're going to be tithing, they generally take out what they pay in income tax, because that's not money you ever owned anyway. Going back to our point before about going to jail. So let's say a person's after-tax income, I'm just making up numbers in order to be to have easy math. So a person's after-tax income is $100,000. So they've calculated they have $10,000. Is it better for that person to say, I'm going to give 2 $5,000 gifts to specific causes, and I don't want to name any because then I'm going to exclude some, and that's a very bad idea. But they say, I know 2 worthy causes that help needy people, and I'm going to give $5,000 this one, $5,000 this one, and that's it. Or should they say, it would be better for me to give 20 causes, $500 each, or you can go further, right? You can just divide it down. What would you say based on what we've said? Yeah,
I would say they're all equal. Both are equal because you're giving. I mean, the end result is not the tax receipt. It's not the fact that you're recognized. I think it's the fact that God recognizes that you're giving, because it is a rabbinical, you said, law as opposed to a. Halacha, whatever.
Right, so to clarify what I was saying before, because I realized that I said it very quickly and mixed together a few different things, the biblical law is the requirement to help people in need. I see somebody in need, I have to help them. What may be rabbinic or may be custom is the 10% standard. But the actual aid is a biblical responsibility. But what you're saying fundamentally is, look, you're helping people, you're giving out the same sum of money in the end, so you're presumably making an impact on people to the degree that you're giving that sum, whether it goes to...
And the other question would be, someone who can't afford but gives, as opposed to someone who can afford and gives greater, is it equal? I would think it is equal. I mean, in the sense that not the amount of money, but the fact of giving.
So we have a principle within Judaism in general, which is everybody is supposed to do what they can, as long as you focus your heart towards God. You do what you're capable of doing, and that's true for this mitzvah and true for every mitzvah, all the more so if what we're talking about is developing your mercy. So for the person who is a person who has millions to give, so for them to give the 10,000 is nothing. They haven't developed their mercy at all.
But the other thing is, what about a cumulative meaning that you give every day as opposed to giving once or twice a year.
So that's also part of this question. That's part of the question of the multiple gifts. I would agree with that. But
I would think that it's a matter of striking a balance, because the larger the gift, you might say it's more effective. On the other hand, giving multiple gifts will be of a greater, spiritual or benefit to the individual. So I think that you've got this tension, and then the individual has to try to find the right balance. So yes, give more, I would think, more gifts, smaller amounts, but don't give $10,001 gifts.
Well, what do you mean when you say it has more spiritual benefit if you give many?
Well, in the sense of sensitizing.
In terms of developing your mercy.
Yes.
Good. So I'm going to come back to that point. So two other comments that I wanted to make sure to.
Just in keeping with that, there are thresholds that you have to achieve in order to make it effective. So let's say if it's possible to consider tzedakah for educational purposes, to give somebody enough money to go to a proper university, over that threshold, over a trade school, where one will enable them in 3 or 4 years to be self-sufficient, while the other one will perpetually keep them poor.
So there's a matter of impact.
And there have been studies on the governmental level that foreign aid to certain to poorer countries have happened that it's always below a certain threshold. So, for instance, you're doing a road project, but you never give them enough money to finish it, and then the rains come in, and the next year, 50% you have to redo. Whereas if you give enough to get it done, you've passed that threshold, and you don't have to.
Right. So giving a worthwhile gift, I think it's necessary within this discussion to stipulate that if you're doing a lot of small gifts, they're going to be meaningful gifts, and meaningful in the sense that you're not reaching the point of diminishing returns by having gone so small. Agreed.
I'm just wondering if it depends on, which is sort of irrelevant, well, it's not irrelevant, it depends on your passion. If you're passionate about your $10,000 gift, give it. If you're passionate about $1,001 dollar gifts, give to them, depending on.
So that's an interesting question, meaning the role that the mitzvah has effectively in motivating you and ensuring that you're going to continue to do it, right? For the person to engage in the mitzvah in a way that's going to support a future mitzvah. That's a very interesting point as well. I hear you. Take a look at number 9, please. The passage in the Talmud talking about tithing. One who gives all of his tithes to one Kohen brings famine to the world. Meaning, you may have helped one guy, but what about everybody else? Now you'll say, well, let everybody else give everybody else, right? I'm one guy, I gave one guy, I helped one family. And you can indeed make that argument. However, generally speaking, and there is quite a bit of material on this, that suggests that one should spread out what one gives in order to maximize the aid to people, recognizing the point about making sure it has an impact and that it's able to do the job. But also take a look at number 10, and this comes back to the point about improving one's mercy. Rambam, Maimonides. Great qualities will not be achieved via great deeds. He's commenting on a line I should explain in Pirkei Avot, which says that Hakol lefi rov hamaaseh. Everything is based on rov hamaaseh, which literally means how much you do. It's evaluating. Mitzvah says everything is based on how much you do. So look what he says. Great qualities will not be achieved via great deeds, but via a great number of deeds. For example, one who gives 1,000 dinar to a suitable recipient once to one person will not achieve generosity via this one great deed, as will one who gives 1,000 dinar over 1,000 occasions, each one generously. Now, I don't know the exchange rate on the dinar that he's talking about. I don't even know if he means a regular dinar, a gold dinar. There were different dinarim, but it's not the point. The message that he's trying to present here is, each time you give, you make an impact on yourself. And so giving more times is actually good. I once knew a fellow who, I've been telling this story for so long that I don't remember anymore if I knew the fellow who said it or if I knew someone who I heard it from. But it was either from a Lubavitch Shaliach or somebody quoting a Lubavitch Shaliach. And he was talking about competition between tzedakah organizations. Chabad had moved into a community and there was some, issue of, they're going to be draining resources. And his response was that writing a check is a use of a muscle. And every muscle needs to be exercised. And so if you get people into the mode of giving tzedakah, they'll give more tzedakah. That was his way to look at it. I wish I could remember whether I heard it from the one who said it or somebody quoting him. But I think there's a lot to be said for that. So because my goal is not just to assist the needy and to mirror biblical tithes, but it's also about developing my own mercy, the argument can be made, I should in fact give smaller gifts, more of the smaller gifts, not to take away from the person who says, I'm going to give the 5,000 here and the 5,000 there. They're doing the mitzvah without any doubt. But there's something to be gained by doing the smaller gifts that you lose if you just do it once or twice. That's one application of this. Yeah.
Human.
So that actually, that is a perfect lead-in to the second application of this, which is the question of giving directly to the needy versus using an umbrella fund. Right? Based on what we said about working on your mercy, the argument can be made that giving directly to a needy person has more of an impact that on the giver, as opposed to, I got my call from UJA, will you give the same thing or more to the annual campaign? Yes, fine, done. Right? You got my credit card number and I don't have to think about it again. As opposed to having an interaction with a human being, which makes much more of an impact on the giver. Now, obviously there are mitigating factors here that would argue for working with an umbrella fund. For example,
the pride of the person receiving it.
Right.
Their dignity.
We value anonymity to try to help people who are needy. It's something that we may come back to later, depending on which route we go with this. But the Talmud tells the story of how a sage used to leave money by the door of a pauper every day. And one time the pauper wanted to catch him, and he wanted to know, who's helping me? And he ran away to avoid being seen. Like, the idea of anonymity and protecting the dignity of the recipient is very important. So you don't want to reach a point where you're specifically looking to give to people to build up your mercy and then embarrassing them as a result. That's kind of self-defeating. The other point is that umbrella funds do bring in expertise that people otherwise don't have. So that the history of Jewish communities was that they always had these kinds of funds. Maimonides words it most beautifully in source number... it's not in there. It's... I thought I had brought it on here, but... there it is, number 13. I like the way that he words it here. He says, "Me olam lo ra'inu v'lo shamanu bekal mi Yisrael." He says, we have never heard, we have never seen a Jewish community that didn't have kupa shel tzedakah, a tzedakah fund. He says, there's no such thing. You can't have a Jewish community without a communal tzedakah fund. It's not acceptable. So that communities had this. And there's a lot of discussion about how these were maintained. The Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet, writing in 13th century Spain, talks about how these funds were supported by a progressive tax in which people gave according to their means. It wasn't a flat tax 10% thing, which actually can be viewed as regressive technically, but it was actually a progressive tax. These funds had to be run by experts who would manage them professionally. And that's what I brought you before 13. In number 11, we talk about the responsibility of the administrator to provide accounts for the donors so that they can tell them exactly what is being done and be above suspicion. So that the Machaber of Yosef Karo in number 11 says we don't demand accounts from collectors. You just have to appoint people who are known, credible people. But rather, the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isterlis, says, it's a good idea for them to present accounts, and that's only if they're known to be righteous. If you don't have people with a track record, then they're required to present an accounting of what they're doing. That doesn't mean you embarrass the recipient by saying, I gave this amount to so-and-so. But it means that you provide an annual report, and the annual report, just like a business does, I come back to my point about running it like a business. So you say, we received this amount of money in donations, or came from these, from organizations, it came from individuals, however it was, and we spend this much on, you know, local, you know, local personal needs, this much went to organizations, this much went overseas. You have to run it properly is what he's talking about here. And Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, to put it in something more contemporary, writing in the 20th century about this, he talks about the need for communal funds. He was, and he supports the idea of having a community fund. He believes that that is necessary. The only caveat he has in that response, and I didn't bring it on the sheet, is that you can't create a fund that ends up harming the needy. Meaning, if you create a community fund and say, now all needy people who come to our city are required to only collect from the fund, and they're not allowed to seek their needs from individuals, right? Feinstein says that's inappropriate. Yeah.
That is a bit questionable, because when you give to Israel, you can go to the military, you can go to, you know, the poor, you can go to whatever sources, hospitals, whatever. Yeah. So you really don't know if you're saying it's harming someone. And I'm not making a question out of this, because you have to be protected, but it could go to the military, where it could harm the needy. Not to mean needy Jews, but the needy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, I mean, there's a...
So I'm going to choose not to address the military question. Uh-huh. But overall, you definitely are justified in having funds that in the same way as in investments. You have investment funds that are going to invest in particular sectors. I think for Tzedakah also, there could be an umbrella fund that takes care of health issues. There could be an umbrella fund that deals with matters of poverty.
It's a large spectrum.
Yes,
and that's
correct.
Really what it is, and if you don't know,
right? And the idea is simply to, on the one hand, I want people to be personally involved in giving to directly to recipients because it's important for them. I think that, you know, when you see people who are asking at street corners and who are, you know, appear to be homeless, you know, I think it's important for kids, especially growing up, to actually give to them, to learn that, that you help.
The other thing, it should be related to an individual needs as opposed to an environmental or something else.
Right, so that goes back to something we had discussed. I think you may have been out at that point when we were discussing it, but I think that there is an issue of, assisting individual needy people and not as much on the institutional, you know, create a hospital type of a level. Or at least that's not the majority of one's tzedakah. But we just got through the first two items and a bunch of other things along the way, and we still have some time. So my question to you is, which of the following three would you like us to address? One is local needs versus Israel. The second one is aiding versus enabling. And the third one is donor recognition. We can probably hit two out of three, I think. Depend a little bit on the conversation, as always. But what would people prefer out of those?
I'd like two.
Israel?
Two, the aiding versus...
Aiding versus enabling. Okay. Any... Nope. Okay, so we'll do that. So I'm going to start with the Israel versus local needs. If you take a look, this is the most technical out of the remaining three, but take a look at source number 14. The Gemara Bava Metzia. Rabbi Yosef, one of the sages, talks about prioritization among recipients. And he says, if you have a choice between your own poor, meaning family, and those of your city, choose your own poor first, family first. If you have a choice between the poor of your city and the poor of another city, choose the poor of your city first. Your city comes before other cities. And of course, we understand a basic logic to that. Of if every city takes care of themselves, then everybody will be fine. Also, these are people you see, and you can't turn away from them to say, well, I'm going to go help people I don't see. But what's missing from this line is any reference to Israel. It's family local, and then other. However, take a look at source number 15, verse in Deuteronomy. When there is a pauper among you, one of your brethren in one of your gates, in your land which Hashem your God is giving you, dot, 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 and I bolded it in the Hebrew, right? Your brother, one of your gates, in your land which Hashem is giving you. So based on that, we get a midrash, which is in number 16. They did something funny when they printed this, but that's fine. They, if you take a look at number 16, just flip over the page. In one of your gates, residents of your city precede residents of other cities, right? Because it's your gate that comes first. In your land, residents of the land, meaning Israel, precede residents outside of the land in Chutzala Aretz. Israel has priority based on the biblical verse. And in fact...
Wait a minute. Does that mean, just so I understand it, whether you're a resident of Israel or not, it's applicable to you.
Correct. It's right. Not just saying to an Israeli, Israel comes first, because that would already come under local first. So take a look at number 17. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, just says straight, Israelis precede those who dwell outside of Israel. Not only that, the Chasim Sofer of Moshe Sofer says that within Israel, Jerusalem comes first, because Jerusalem is considered to have greater status than the rest of the land. However, what this doesn't address is where exactly in the hierarchy do we place Israel's needs? Does that mean that all Israeli needs are by default top of the line? Right? Meaning, let's say you say family still comes first, but after family, any need in Israel, there's a community in Israel that wants to build a park. Does that come before a local community that maybe needs to fund a school? Like, where exactly do you place this? The Chidor, Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai, actually served some time as a tzedakah collector. And he talked about this. He was asked, I think in a community in Italy, about people coming from Israel and taking funds that otherwise would have gone to local tzedakah efforts. And so first of all, he denied this was going on. He said they only collect from specific people who are known to want to support the land of Israel. Nothing's changed in our world. Everyone's got their priorities. So he says they go to certain people who are known as big supporters of life in Israel. They don't take from the community collection. That's number one. Number two, though, he said even if this does happen, still, he said, the cases in Israel are of dire need. He talks about Pidyon Shvuyim, needing to redeem captives, people who have been taken captive and need to be ransomed. And he says, the value of settling the land of Israel is so great that for sure this overrides any sort of local need. He took a very dramatic stance. Halakhic authorities in general seem to disagree, and seem to say that the local paupers would precede Israeli paupers. That's the normal standard. So take a look at source number 18, Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, known as the Bach. It appears that when both collectors, are from another town, it says that Israelis precede residents outside of Israel. But the poor of his own town outside Israel obviously precede the poor of another town, even if they are Israeli, as implied by Rabbi Yosef in the Gemara, who did not put Israel up there. So he says it will be local needy, and then Israel, before getting to others who are not from the community. And this is quoted in various sources as halacha, the shach, the nitziv. This seems to be that the standard approach, although I should note that Rav Kook seemed to disagree in source number 19. He says the poor of Israel are also called the poor of your town. He says they are the equivalent of. This is a hot debate. It's always a debate. Did he write this when he was living in Lithuania? Or did he write this when he was already in Israel? It's an interesting question. But that's his ruling. Yeah.
It's hard to do this without a timing. If you're talking about 1939 in Germany, then Israel would come first because the German community may probably lost. If you're talking about now or maybe in 1950, then obviously, or maybe not obviously, Israel would become first because it's in more danger than we are here. So I think timing is really a factor which would influence your, or should influence your decision as to the value of the gift, as well as
right, and that speaks to the question that I introduced this with, which was the question of: are we talking about the equivalent of life saving needs locally? Are we talking about where they want to build a park there, and we want to fund a school? You know, I think that the assumption has to be we're talking about equivalent levels of need, which, as you know, will change over time and change over the depending on what the cause is. And I'm not saying that to diminish the importance of parks. They're of great importance not only for the individuals who use them, but for the identity and durability of the community. But yes, I think you're right about that. Okay, let's talk aiding versus enabling, because that's also a fun one. The donor recognition one is also fun. I recommend looking at the sources on the sheet because they're there. But in terms of aiding versus enabling, this is also a very big question. Clearly, we prioritize helping somebody become self-sufficient. I didn't bring it on the sheet, but the Rambam, Maimonides, has a hierarchy of 8 levels of tzedakah, and the greatest level of tzedakah is not what people usually think of as tzedakah at all. It's getting somebody a job, giving somebody the means of working, or working your way down the hierarchy, lending them money that they can then invest in being able to do work. So you provide, you know, loans to a farmer, so the farmer is able to hire workers, get seed, get the equipment necessary, and work. If you take a look at source number 20, that emerges in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, when Rabbi Yosef Karo rules, there is a mitzvah of lending to the poor of Israel. Israel here does not mean land of Israel. It just means Jews. That's his phrase. And this is a greater mitzvah than tzedakah. He's calling this higher than tzedakah. You think of tzedakah, you know, as including all the aid you give to others. What he's saying is lending is greater than giving somebody a gift. Why? Rabbi Yonasan Ibeshitz in source number 21 says, because when it comes to tzedakah, when you're giving a handout, the person already needs to ask. He's lost shame. He's now asking for just to be given something. Better to help somebody before they reach that point. Obviously, if I'm choosing between lending to someone to start a business and giving somebody food so that they can eat that day, the food is still going to come first. It's a more dire need. Nonetheless, the argument that is being made here is that you want to help people become self-sufficient. That's really what we would like, and to get to people before they reach the point where they're no longer self-sufficient. That's number one. Number two, if you have somebody who you suspect is dishonest, then we do say, you know what, better not to better to make sure you're directing your funds towards those who honestly need. The Talmud has this line in number 22, let's be grateful to those who are ramayim, tricksters, for if not for them, we would sin daily. What do you mean? Because there's a biblical verse that says that in the event that you see somebody and you don't help him, that person is going to call out to God and you will be liable for not having provided assistance. So I may not notice the legitimate people. However, the trickster is grabbing my attention and making me notice everybody, and then I will end up giving to those who are legitimate. But the implication of this, aside from this interesting take on people who are not legitimate, but the upshot of it is, the mitzvah is to give to people who really do need. So that Jewish law discusses investigating recipients and making sure that they actually are needy. If somebody asks you for food, we are taught, I didn't bring it on here, but the Rambam says it, in the event that somebody asks you for food, then you don't investigate. But if someone asks for other things that are not as dire and not as immediate, then you investigate first. Now, obviously, you can't do that with everything. A person comes to your door and says, I'm marrying off my child. They give you a letter from the VOD, and the letter says, this is legit, and that's what you work with. That's what you have.
Wait, but they usually don't say that. They usually just say that this guy is a God-fearing and learned person.
No, that's not what the letters say. The letters that are, the local certificates that are issued are, yeah, the local certificates actually are much more.
Right. No, then I stand corrected. I'm wrong.
But just because we're running out of time, I want to make sure just to address the point on this, which is I think to a certain extent it depends on the amount one is giving. The person is giving smaller amounts that don't impact their ability to give to others, they can be more forgiving about it. If you're giving larger amounts, then recognize you're taking away from your ability to support others. There's a greater duty to investigate. And again, to give in a way that's going to enable somebody to be able to live, and enabling somebody to be able to become independent. That's really what we want to do, not to enable somebody to continue to collect from others. What if you're not sure? Right? What if you don't know? I don't know. You know, I mean, I can do what we discussed before. I can try to earmark and say, this is meant to be for food, this is meant to be for clothing, this is meant to be to find work, or whatever it is. But at the end of the day, what if I don't know? So you have to always keep in mind, we're dealing with what's called in the language of Torah a suffik deoraisa. It's doubt in a biblical matter, right? Meaning, this mitzvah of helping someone in need, leave aside the 10% discussion, is fundamentally a biblical issue. So because we're dealing with a biblical issue, we always rule strictly. So you have to err on the side of stringency and support if you don't know. It could even be suffek pikuach nefesh. It's doubt about saving a life, right? On Shabbos, if somebody suffers some kind of an injury and I'm not sure whether they need to go to the hospital or not, I think it's legitimately possible they do need to, you take them to the hospital. It's suffek pikuach nefesh. If I'm willing to override Shabbos for that, then I'm also, you know, I should be willing also when it comes to tzedakah. But if a person has a sense that by giving they're perpetuating a problem and not solving it, then I think under the rules for tzedakah, they should be looking for ways to help this person get beyond being a tzedakah recipient. That's what I would say. The point about the donor recognition you'll see on the sources there is that it's a very old Jewish tradition with many reasons for its existence. But you can look at the sources later. Thank you very much.
Thank you.